Welcome, everybody, to Cycle Jerks Podcast, episode 114. We are pleased to be joined by Chuck Davis, the creator of the Vintage DH Mountain Bike Group on Facebook. This is a massive group. Chuck is also heading up the bike giveaway coming up here in Pleasant Hill in on September 23rd, I think it is. And and he's also just generally a great guy, and I've known him for 21 years, as we just discussed. Chuck, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, let's elaborate on how big of a heart this guy is. This is not just a bike giveaway; it's for foster kids, right?
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Will you let our guest talk, Dave?
Okay. No, it's our show.
It'd be a lot easier if I just sat back and drank coffee.
Yeah. So, Chuck, your story is pretty incredible. And, you know, I've known you for a long time, and I didn't really know the story until we ran into each other just recently at Frame Up. Can you share your history, like growing up, and why this bike giveaway is something that means so much to you?
Yeah, I hate talking about myself, but it's for a good cause. You and I have known each other since 1997, Mike. Mm-hmm. We met when I was working at Hank and Frank Bikes. I was bike mechanic there. And I can't remember, were you a Giant rep, then a GT rep, then a Giant rep again? Or were you GT and then Giant?
It was GT first, and then Giant. Yeah.
Chuck, just I'm going to cut you off again. Just kudos for putting up with Mike for that long. Holy shit.
Oh, dude.
There's one other person I think that has, and that's his wife, Stella.
Well, he put up with me a lot. I was racing both cross country and downhill. I'm 6'3". My racing weight, I was maybe 165. I've broken more than 35 bikes. I only broke a couple of Giant bikes. So kudos to Giant, but I broke the AC. Those asymmetrical chain stays always broke.
Yep.
But my MCM carbon never broke. And the only one we ever broke, we broke on purpose because Giant had a lifetime warranty. And I didn't tell Mike this at the time, but my buddy wanted an upgrade.
Been there, done that.
Oh my gosh.
And then when I flipped over to
I'm sending this to Giant Corporate as soon as we're done, Chuck.
Nothing was wrong with my TCX the last year either. So I just needed a new one. I like the color better. So
right.
Oh my word.
Then I flipped over to GT right when the iDrives came out, and I broke 15 iDrives. Just because I'm so tall, I run so much seat post, and that seat mast wasn't machined properly, and it created a pivot, and I broke 15 of them. So Mike put up with me because I was like, dude, it was like every time I did a tune-up on my bike, I just changed the frame and cables and housing, right? It was just part of standard maintenance protocol.
Well, they had a real issue with those large and extra large frames on the iDrive.
Yeah.
They were piling up. We didn't have a problem with the small and the mediums, but yeah, those bigger ones, it was always an issue.
Yeah. And I probably should have run an extra large, but back then people thought that like nimble handling was important. Right. But dude, I still love those bikes. I just built my daughter up a 1999 iDrive with an XT kit and a SID. She's, you know, she's 11 years old and it's totally rad for her.
Awesome.
Yeah. So Mike's put up with me too. Cause dude, like I was working the warranty. Like, dude, I had frames break on the very first day I rode them. So Mike and GT just kept giving me bikes.
Unreal.
So we go back a long ways. What Mike didn't know was I was working at Hank and Frank Bikes at the time, and I want to try not to get emotional.
Think of Frank. That might help.
No, dude. I really didn't want to work for Hank and Frank, but I needed a job. I was homeless and had no job, and I got a loan for $750 from a friend to pay first and last months on a rental apartment on Detroit and Concord, living with my friend Judd, who I talked to you about, who was working at Hank and Frank, and now he's gone on into aerospace. And so I was like, totally broke, totally destitute, needed a job, went and applied at Hank and Frank, and I really didn't want to, but Frank hired me. And, you know, since then I've been doing pretty good. But leading up to that, I had grown up in foster care. I had an adoptive set of parents, four or five different foster homes. At one time they ran out of foster homes and they put me in juvenile hall, you know, when they just run out and like, you got to go somewhere, you know, they put you in the,
wow,
the basement of unwanted children. And as you might expect about that time, I wasn't doing really well in school. I had a 0.3 GPA.
I mean, we're laughing, but it's, I mean, it's tragic.
No, really. I mean,
you know what I mean?
Like right now it's, I actually want to frame that thing. And yeah. I talk to kids a little bit about it sometimes, because I know like really smart, really intelligent kids sometimes still struggle and will fail. And so I had this, I got into racing cars at one point and I bought a 2019 Corvette Grand Sport and my license plate was 0.3 GPA. And it was kind of like a dual message. It was kind of like, it doesn't really matter where you come from, you know? And it was also like a big F you to the teachers that told me I'd never go anywhere, you know?
Right.
So I had seen a Ferrari like 488 with a license plate that said 2.7 GPA. And I'm like, hold my beer, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I have this nephew who is just a brilliant little kid and he's struggling in school and like, I don't know, he's going to figure it out. Like, don't worry, dude, keep working hard, stay out of trouble. You'll find something at some point that you excel at. And right now it just isn't school. So
yeah,
don't give up, keep going. And those were kind of some of the life lessons I had to teach myself, like growing up in foster care with seven different sets of parents. It's like, either I had seven sets of parents who, by the way, were bad, or I had more, or I had none, right? So I really had to come up with, I realized at 10 years old, like, I was different, right? And like, what am I going to do about it? And I had to come up with methods and strategies on how the heck am I not going to end up, you know, like a statistic, because the statistics are really bad for foster kids. Trying not to get emotional here.
All right, sorry if you do.
Yeah savvy stuff.
Yeah I was listening to a podcast last night with I think his name is Rob Thomas. He's a sociologist, but he grew up like me. He had seven different foster homes and then he went into the military because he was like, dude, I gotta somehow get out of this, right? And now he's like a PhD sociologist and he was doing a podcast and he said the outcomes for foster kids are basically worse than any other socioeconomic category you can think of. For example, only 3% of foster kids graduate from college, right? That's worse than the lowest income bracket of anybody in the United States by 400%. Wow. The lowest economic bracket kids or kids that come from that bracket usually graduate college at a rate of 11%, right? So foster kids are like a little bit of an ignored category. Like people don't think about it, but there are a lot. On any given day, there are 400 to 500,000 foster kids in the United States of like from everywhere, right? Half of them are white, half of them or quarter of them are black, quarter of them are Hispanic. It's like when you're in foster care, like race doesn't matter. You're all in it together. And so I grew up, you know, just in the Bay Area, but, you know, my brothers and sisters were Mexican, Indian, African-American, like, whatever. They're all just your brothers and sisters. It doesn't really matter what color you are. You just know that you're in a bad spot, and how are you going to get out of it? And I came up with just a few sort of rubrics, and one was, like, don't give up, you know? And then another one was, Grandma Anderson at one point was chastising me. She said, Charles, if you continue to lie with the pigs, you're going to begin to smell like them. And this was about the time that I had a 0.3 in GPA in high school and not doing anything good with my life. Was not like a horrible kid. I hadn't, like, you know, had any run-ins with the law, but like I realized I was hanging out with people that were starting to get into drugs. We stopped playing baseball and football after school and we started drinking and smoking and things like this. And about that time in the state of California, foster kids weren't legally allowed to drive cars. And in foster care, they generally try to keep you within the school district that you came from. So you have like some semblance of normalcy, but then, you know, they'll put you on a foster home wherever they can find a foster home. So oftentimes foster kids are, you know, quite a ways away. They live quite a ways away from where they go to school, and you're not allowed to drive. And that, you know, becomes a problem. So about that time, I believe it was Congressman George Miller had come up with like 200 cheap Walmart road bikes, just like the worst of the worst. He donated them to foster kids. And that was how I was getting back and forth to school, was like riding this super crappy road bike. I'm kind of like a geeky person at heart. And I had the California, I'm blanking on the name of the book. The book on all the legal rules of the road regarding automobiles in California. And one of the rules for bicycle safety, for a bicycle to be allowed to run on the road, was it had to be able to lock up at least one wheel. And I'm like, okay, let's see if this thing is even legal to ride. And it's like, dude, the brakes didn't work on that thing at all. Like, they just gave me this total shit bike and the thing's not even illegal. But that was how I got back and forth to school. But I was living at the base of Mount Diablo with a foster family. And at that time, my biological sister, my background is like, we all got blown up and spit out and put into different homes and all that jazz.
Do you mind sharing a couple of things? So you said your biological sister, how many brothers and sisters did you have that, I mean, biologically?
Yeah, so I kind of have like my primary family, which was my adoptive family, which is where my name comes from. But then I have all these other like foster families, and then you'll have siblings. And then I have a biological sister, and then I have two adoptive siblings, a brother and a sister, who were Mexican. But when you grow up that way, I didn't even realize we weren't like of the same race. You don't. Yeah.
Good.
I didn't even figure it out until like I was in college and I look back at an old picture. I'm like, oh, dude. Yeah.
And who's Grandma Anderson? Because she sounds like a wise woman.
She was part of the Davis family. The Davis family was really a shit family. They should have gone to jail. They did horrible abuse. To my dude. They did horrible abuse to my sisters and really bad abuse to me and my brother. So unfortunately, my name comes from a place where it's like, F those guys. But dude, the other thing I've learned is that you can learn from every experience and everywhere you go. So Grandma Anderson, as much as, you know, I rue the Davis family and my own name, I learned something from her, but she was chastising me and I flipped it into something good.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
She's like, Charles, if you continue to lie with the pigs, you're going to smell like them. And it was this time in high school where I was starting to get into drugs. I was failing. I was getting into trouble. I'm like, you know what? I wonder if the opposite is true. And I fired all my friends. I was riding this total shit bike back and forth to school, but I started riding it up Mount Diablo, riding it up Northgate Road. And I'd try and drag my sister up there and she would like tap out and I would just like keep going. I was a lean beanpole, as much of a climber as you can be when you're 6'3", 165. And I tore that bike apart. But I was working at Round Table Pizza for $3.65 an hour. And I saved up to buy a 1990 Mongoose Eibach Pro with like LX and DX components. And I rode the tar out of that bike. I broke the frame. I broke the fork. I ripped the free hub body right off the rear wheel at the Sea Otter Classic. But that like really got me into it. And I remember riding up by Barbecue Terrace, which I don't know if you guys know that one.
Oh, yeah.
It's the fire road just below the junction on Mount Diablo, which is heinously steep. It's probably like a 20% climb. And I was super stupid. I have asthma. And I'm riding up Barbecue Terrace. And I got halfway up and I decided to stop and light up a cigarette. This is when I was hanging out with, you know, kids doing drugs, failing school, not really a great kid. But mountain biking, I mean, it was a necessity. I had to get to and from school. And then I was just riding it like all the time. And I stop on Barbecue Terrace and smoke a cigarette, instant asthma attack. And I'm like, something's got to give. I can't do, you know, all this. You know, I'm either going to ride bikes and be healthy and drop this group of friends, which are negative influences, or I'm going to do the opposite. And it was that kind of rubric that I took from Grandma Anderson in reverse. If you lie with the pigs, you're going to smell like them. What if you do the opposite? And so that was the other kind of mental rubric I came up with. The first one was like, never give up. Second one was surround yourself with positive people that you want to be like and that you want to learn from, right? And I just figured I'd give it a try. It's like, okay, maybe if I do this, things will be better. And I remember I like basically fired my friends like maybe that day or that week, but it was pretty much immediate. I quit hanging out with that group. I ate lunch by myself. I was like a total loner for at least a month, but I was riding my bike, right? And then I ended up meeting cyclists and I started making cycling friends, got a job at the bike shop. I broke the mongoose eyebok and had to, you know, I had to replace the fork with a Scott Unishock, which was like one of the first suspension forks ever. And I had to learn how to rebuild all the parts myself and weld the frame where I'd cracked it. And I just kept riding my bike, but I had figured out two things. Don't give up, surround yourself with positive people. And I kept doing that. And my GPA gradually around that time increased from 0.3 to 0.6 to 0.9 to 1.6. Finally, by senior year, I was up to like 3.8 or something. Wow. And I had gotten a pretty good SAT. I'd gone through like SAT boot camp and was taking all these vitamins and herbs that are supposed to help your brain and receptors and all these things. I still had a really bad track record from school, but like you couldn't ignore a 3.8 GPA and a pretty good SAT. And I got into St. Mary's College in the high potential program, which far as I know, I'm the only white person to ever have gone through it.
Really?
When I got in there, it was all African-American and Mexican people. And they're like, are you Mexican? I'm like, no, but it was a program that St. Mary's College has for people they think maybe need or deserve a second chance, right? So now I'm like really hardcore into bikes. I'd by that time raced Sea Otter. I'd built this performance bike, you know, with XTR components. I was working full time at Chevron in Walnut Creek on Ignacio and Civic, living on campus at St. Mary's, rowing crew at 5 a.m. So I would work from like 5 p.m. to midnight in Walnut Creek, ride my bike back and forth from St. Mary's to Walnut Creek, get up at 5 a.m. and row crew, and then go mountain biking like after school. And I was riding like 300-400 miles a week. You know,
savage. Yeah.
And I only started the crew team
on a shit bike, right?
At that time,
the Eibach wasn't bad.
At that point, I had a performance M007, which had like XTR, and I had built up some White Industries hubs and had a Manitou 2. I only joined the crew team because I wanted to be in good enough shape to race mountain bikes come spring. So crew was like my winter training thing. But yeah, I made it through St. Mary's fine because I chose a course of study that just really worked for me. It really, you know, piqued my curiosity. It was really hands-on and did fine. After failing out,
what was the study? What'd you study?
It's called Integral Liberal Arts, and it's kind of hard to explain. It's a classics program. You start in around 400 BC, and you learn math, language, art and science of the day. There are no textbooks. You read the original writings of the authors, preferably in the language in which it was written. So we had to learn ancient Greek.
Wow.
And translate, you know, Aristotle and Plato.
I'm sure that ancient Greek comes into play quite a bit in your daily life, huh?
Yeah, I've got a whole large group of friends that I can talk to. We translated the Word According to John. So the Bible was originally written in Hebrew and Greek because the Roman Empire, right?
Yeah.
So we translated the Word According to John from the original Greek. But then we had to translate like Aristotle and Plato. And when we did Euclidean geometry, we translated from Greek. And then you go from there chronologically up until present day. So you learn Ptolemy, Copernicus, Kepler, all the philosophers of the day. worked our way up to special and general relativity in Newtonian physics. Newton, within the Principia, those were the two books that he had written, had these drawings of like machines that he supposedly created to do things like to describe arcs of parabolas and stuff like this. What I later found out is he never actually made these machines. It's kind of BS. He made a few of them, but most of them were just like artistic renderings, but we actually would build them, you know? When we were studying, I'm just going to do a quick aside because you can tell I'm kind of a geeky, naturally curious guy. And I finally found something I was good at, which I go back to that 0.3 GPA and kids aren't doing well. I'm like, dude, just keep going. You're going to be okay. Right.
Yeah.
When we studied chemistry, we studied Lavoisier. So Lavoisier was the first guy to really describe chemistry in writing. And, you know, a lot of the basic tenets of Lavoisier and chemistry are like the preservation of elements, right? So any chemical reaction, you neither create nor destroy anything. You change things. And great ways to prove this, for example, would be brewing beer, right? And so when you brew beer, the little yeast create carbon dioxide, which then off gases. And if you can capture the carbon dioxide and weigh the carbon dioxide off gas, it should equal the amount of weight loss within the beer you brewed. So that was like the kind of chemistry that we did. When we were studying Galileo, we would go up to the church bell at St. Mary's and drop shit off and watch how fast it went. When we studied Ptolemy, we created like the plinths and everything that he used to study the arc of the stars, which is really how he created trigonometry. Trigonometry was originally created for navigation. So we go out in the middle of the night.
Don't invite me over for dinner because I'm going to be lost.
I'm not smart enough to be in this conversation.
That's like a big message that I have for kids, especially who are not doing great in school. It's like, dude, continue at it, but
yeah,
you're going to find something, you know?
Right.
And I believe
everybody has something in them, right? No matter where, how lost they might be.
Yeah,
they've got something that will ignite them and get them motivated, and you just have to keep searching and have to find it. And so many times people just, you know, kids give up. They get the 0.3 GPA, and then they're just like, well, I guess, you know, I'm not very smart, and this is my fate. But it's not the case. You just have to keep searching for that thing that you're inspired by, and that it's not even like work to learn about. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, you can hear I get all fired up. I'm just like a super geek at heart. So currently I do technology consulting.
Shocking.
Pardon? I'm just a geek. You've seen, you know, on my Facebook, I do like kind of gourmet cooking. I build custom bikes and whatever. And so I've kind of found something that worked for me. And so that 0.3 GPA is kind of like a badge of honor, because it was, dude, it doesn't matter where you come from. Don't give up. Surround yourself with positive influence and positive people that you want to learn from and you want to be like. And just, you know, keep going from there and stay out of trouble is the other thing, you know. So the vast majority of foster kids end up a statistic. You know, they end up within a year and a half of emancipation, which is when you leave the system. Your likelihood of ending up in jail, on drugs, or dead is about 75%, right?
Wow.
It's really, really bad. I mean, when I graduated high school, I was kicked out of my foster home within 2 days, you know, and literally had nothing. Ended up homeless. Riding my bike, literally all I had was the clothes on my body and the clothes on my back. And so like the day you met me, I was like fresh off the streets. You know, I was like a feral kid. I had no parents, no upbringing. I kind of learned to create my own by surrounding myself, you know, with positive people. Mike, I consider you one. Another one.
Thank you.
You know, and like I said, you can learn and take positive influences from almost anywhere, including Grandma Anderson. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rob Kaplan was another one of my reps. The sun is coming right into my eyes. I might have to put my sunglasses on.
Please do.
Was another one of my reps back at Hank and Frank. He was our mongoose rep, and he was a really good dude.
Yeah.
And after the bike industry, he got into the dot-com area back in 2000, because that's what was going on. And he pinged me one day. I was working at Wilderness Trail Bikes in Marin. He pinged me one day. He's like, "Chuck D, do you want a job?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I need a bike guy." I'm like, "All right." At that point, I was selling to bike manufacturers, distributors. I was traveling all around North America, doing sales for this dot-com. And, I was like the designated bike guy. Then I also started selling to law enforcement, yada, yada. Long story short was I ended up getting into technology sales. I got an opportunity to go work for a Cisco consulting business, still riding my bike all the time, still racing bikes, racing cross country, racing downhill. Ended up marrying my college sweetheart. My wife and I met in 1992. She was in my major, which my major is super geeky. So we had a class size of 7. So she's known me and she's known me since 1992. So I married her in 2008. We've got a beautiful daughter. I mean, I'm not where I should be. Like, I should be a statistic, right? You know,
well, in a way, like, I always think about these moments in my life where, you know, that 0.3, right? In a way, it's almost like a debt of gratitude should be paid to the teacher that gave you that, right? Or the teachers that gave you that, because that triggered something in you, you know? And it's like, it to this day, you still hang on to it. It still motivates you to this day. And it's a big part of, I think, your success story, you know, in a weird way, like, I grew up racing BMX and, you know, I had this nemesis person that I just, you know, we couldn't stand to look at each other. It was that kind of relationship, right? And but that person made me so much better because of just the nature of the relationship, how badly I wanted to prove him wrong, you know, became like a big thing. And even after, like, long after I proved him wrong, it was still a big motivation for me, you know? And I think that you could point to that 0.3 is like, well, it sucked to get it in the moment, man. From there, everything turned, right?
It's also for me, it is that, it's twofold. It's that, it's kind of the FU to those teachers who told me I'd never amount to anything, because I had teachers do that. And it's also like, you know, I know some kids that are struggling and I know they're freaking brilliant.
Right.
And like, I send this picture of my Corvette on Thunderhill Racetrack, zoomed in on my license plate. I'm like, dude, don't worry about it. Just keep going.
Well, that and a mountain bike take you a long way. Or a bike in general, right?
The mountain bike, cycling just introduced me to positive people all around. And I surround myself intentionally. And I think it's that intentionality that I try to also talk to people about, is you have to do that. And the counter to that, there's a twofold lesson in a lot of things in life. The counter to that is, not only do you need to, when you're in a really bad situation like that, you need to surround yourself with positive influences. But a lot of people, you know, they end up on drugs, they end up addicted, they end up poor, they lose their jobs, they're homeless, what have you. And then they're surrounded, you know, with the quote unquote pigs that Grandma Anderson would tell me about. It's like, well, you got to get out of that, right? Yeah. So you got to surround yourself with positive people that you want to grow and from and be like, and you got to get rid of the negative influences. And sometimes that's really hardcore, you know. Sometimes you have to be kind of brutal. Maybe, you know, people are trying to impress upon me the idea of forgiveness, which maybe at this point in my life, maybe I can. But as a self-preservation tactic, I legally fired my parents when I was 13. I legally emancipated. I had to, you know.
Yeah.
Because they were harassing me and like, dude, I'm already in a bad spot and you're like giving me shit. So I signed letters of emancipation and legally emancipated myself when I was 13. When you're in a bad spot, you need to get rid of the negativity as a self-preservation tactic. Sometimes it's kind of harsh. And you need to surround yourself with positive, right? So that was just another kind of mental rubric that I created. So when I hear from kids that are struggling and talk to kids that are struggling, especially foster kids, because foster kids are surrounded. I mean, they don't have a lot of positive influences. They're not doing great, right? They end up in institutions and drugs and jail, dead, what have you. So I tried to give them some really basic tools, and I only have like three or four like basic kind of mental rubrics that are relatively easy to follow. But that the harshest one is you need to realize when you have negative influences surrounding you that are kind of aiding and abetting negative behavior, and you need to remove those as a self-preservation tactic, right?
Yeah.
And then surround yourself and augment with the positive. So I've always looked for areas and opportunities to help foster kids in any way I can, because like they don't have people helping them, you know, for the most part. Child Protective Services, dude, one of my foster parents is doing life in prison. He, I won't go into details, but he had done such horrific child abuse to so many dozens of foster kids. He's doing life in prison. And part of the reason he was able to get away with it for so long was Child Protective Services didn't do their job, right? Yeah. So like even when you're in foster care, you aren't necessarily in a good spot. Like depending on the state, it varies region by region. 20 to 40% of all foster kids within foster care are abused by their foster parents while they're in foster care, right? So
it's just, I don't want to pour salt in a wound in any way, but it is interesting. And I think it is important for people to understand that, right? Because when I think of a foster family, I'm thinking, here's a family that's opened their doors to take care of somebody that, no, I mean, I'm serious. That's like, that's what a person's lead a sheltered life like me. I'm thinking, wow, how beautiful this family opened their door, cleared out a bedroom, and made room for some kid that was in a bad spot, right? And I bet you there's a million people out there that think the same thing as me, right?
Yeah. So are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't want to shit on foster care, because you know when I say that, depending on the region and state by state, 20 to 40% of foster kids are abused while they're in foster care. That means, you know, 60 to 80% aren't.
Yeah.
Right. And they came from places bad enough that the state took them away. So 60 to 80% of foster kids are probably better off, or at least no worse off. But a large percent of them are as bad or worse off. Right.
Yeah.
So one of my foster dads like was horrible, and he was doing life in prison. And it was because Child Protective Services never went to his house, never looked to see what he was up to. The dude was crazy. He tried to pull mind tricks on me. Jeez. And another one of my self-preservation tactics, which isn't the healthiest, was I just pulled back. I didn't open up to anybody, didn't talk to anybody, stayed the hell away from this guy. And he ended up kicking me out, made up stories about me. He told Child Protective Services all kinds of crazy stuff about me. And that's how I ended up in juvenile hall. But yeah, Child Protective Services is not a panacea, but it needs to be improved, not destroyed, right?
Yeah, it's like so many other, you know, agencies. I feel like they start off with this noble intention, and then somewhere along the way, it just becomes about getting as much money as they can for what they do, and you know, the services go down, and they're just working the system to try to get government funding or whatever. And yeah, it's unfortunate, but
I would submit that maybe the problem is that there isn't enough funding. We spend a lot of money on stupid shit and not stuff where it's important. I mean, there's a lot of money that could be poured, I think, into our education system and into other things. And
for sure,
you know, there's a couple of things that I can think of that don't need more of, but
Shit. Okay. We're not turning this into a political podcast. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Hey, let's talk about the bike build. I think we covered foster care.
So
but let's get into let's
talk about that journey though. So now you've pulled yourself out. You're successful, bike sales, tech sales, right? And mountain biking, now you've decided you go back to a foundation. I mean, I want to hear about exactly what you're doing for it, but when did this start? Your building bikes?
Yeah, so I was sort of recruited by the city of Pleasant Hill some number of years ago by a gal named Mary, I can't remember her name, who was running the administrative side of the Bike Build for Foster Kids. So city of Pleasant Hill, I've always looked for ways to help foster kids. And the barriers to entry are sometimes high, right? You can become a foster parent. That's really hard when you have a full-time job and married wife and kid already. There's something called court-appointed special advocates, CASA, which enables individuals to sort of like adopt a foster kid and become like a role model for them. The barrier to entry of that is extremely high. And I could go into details, but it was just sort of onerous. And so I was always looking for ways I could help foster kids, because I really wanted to give them some idea that, like, dude, if you stay out of trouble, work hard and surround yourself with positive things, you're going to be okay. Generally, like, that's just kind of the way the world works. And I was recruited by the city of Pleasant Hill. The city of Pleasant Hill has their community service day every fall, where they look for programs that members of the community can do good works. And I was recruited, I guess the word got out that I was a bike guy. I mean, I'd worked for various bike shops. I'd worked for bike companies, worked in the bike industry. I've maintained relationships with all the local bike shops. And I'm still riding bikes a ton. I'm still racing, you know, cross country and downhill and breaking every bike I can get my hands on. And so Mary recruited me to run this bike build. And I was able to get, you know, like all the local bike shops out to donate their time. We had like 20, the first year we had like 20 professional mechanics come out, and word got out. I really don't like talking about myself. Word got out that like I was running this thing, and like KPIX tried to come and interview me. I'm like, no, I'm just working on bikes. I didn't really want to talk about myself, but this year I kind of made the mental decision. It's for the greater good. So I ran the bike build for a couple, few years. I took a couple years hiatus, and during that time, Mary had also started her own nonprofit to help kids in other ways. So on the back end, she had been running the administrative side, and I didn't realize how much she was doing, but there's a lot of go-between required with organizations like CASA that I described, the court-appointed special advocates, with Child Protective Services, other foster care organizations, because you got to try to get your hands on how many kids are out there that need bikes of what type? And then you got to find ways to get those bikes. And so people had always been enabled and are still enabled. We'll get down to the brass tacks here in a second. She was running the administrative stuff. So getting bikes donated, finding the organization to get bikes to, then working with me to make sure that we had the resources to fix them up, you know, repair them and get them donated, because these are bikes that are like in people's backyards where the tubes and tires are rotten, the brake pads are gone, stuff like this. So when COVID hit, Mary had already taken her leave, started her own nonprofit. I was no longer there, you know, doing the outreach to bike mechanics and bike shops. And then I'm hearing of another dynamic that I don't have empirical data on, but something have happened with COVID that kind of blew apart the foster care system, where foster kids were moved even further afield than they previously were. So now we're moving foster kids out to the sticks, to like the 209 and things like this, right? Hmm. So that the total number of bikes that had been built and donated just in the last couple of years had dropped from when I was doing it, we were building and donating around 100 bikes. It had dropped down to like 15.
Jeez. Okay. So,
yeah. It's like, dude, what happened? The number of foster kids hasn't dropped, right? On any given day, there's 400,000 to 500,000 foster kids. And so I'm talking to foster care organizations. And I talked to one called the Braid Mission. They're based in Vallejo, and it's basically a husband and a wife. The husband is an ordained minister, and I'm, you know, just trying to get the word out, get my hands on like how many kids are out there that need bikes. Like, hey, this is what's going on. Like, give me a list of kids. And I'm getting the feel that there's fewer and fewer foster care organizations throwing their hats into the ring to avail themselves of free bikes for kids. And so this guy that runs the Braid Mission, which is a nonprofit that helps foster kids, is telling me about this dynamic with COVID. Like, foster care system has gotten even worse, right? Kids are even further from school. They're even further from where they used to live. Nobody's buying them cars. Foster kids are by definition poor, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, shoot. I mean, the need has not decreased. It's probably increased. So this year, I am doing the administrative work that Mary was doing, reaching out to CASA, reaching out to Braid Mission, reaching out to Child Protective Services, working with local bike mechanics. So I have bike mechanics from many of the local bike shops, a lot of the independent bike mechanics that you probably know, Mike. And then trying to get the word out that people can donate bikes. The easiest way would be to drop them off at Pleasant Hill Police Department and just let them know this is for the bike build. And we also have the Bicycle Trails Council making themselves available for any monetary donations so that we have funds to buy tubes, tires, small parts, things like that. So Bicycle Trails Council is a nonprofit. If you donate money, it's tax deductible. If you donate a bike, it's tax deductible. We can give you receipts for that sort of thing. But I'm kind of having to rebuild this. It kind of died on the vine a little bit. So currently, I have about 10 mechanics registered to help me out. I'd be happy to take on as many more mechanics that want to join. In the past, this has been a really fun occasion. For me, it's just a frenzied environment where we're all working on bikes, like yelling for who's got the crazy box wrench that goes with this 1978 weird loose ball, you know, bottom bracket kind of thing. But that's fun. For me, it's just like whatever. It's kind of a bike party. And we line them up and foster kids show up and we size them up and teach them how to use their bike. There are other programs available to get foster kids, you know, involved and introduced to cycling if that's something that they want to do. You know, there's organizations like Barrier Bike Project, Trips for Kids out of Marin that do that sort of thing. And it's just a good thing. Like, worst case scenario, we give a kid that needs transportation some transportation. Best case scenario, we introduce them to something positive. Where they don't have much. And for foster kids, like, I don't feel like, you know, cycling is the only thing they can and should be doing. They need any kind of positive influence they can get, whether that be taking them fishing or teaching them how to cook, even just working on your car with them, just something positive, because they don't have a lot of this. This just happens to be my bailiwick, but like, foster kids, you know, could use help. Anybody listening to this, if you're not in the Bay Area and you don't have a CASA near you, there's probably a foster care organization near you, and there's probably something you can do to help. And it doesn't really matter what. If you want to take them fishing, camping, teach them how to cook. Foster kids aren't really taught basic life skills. We grow up like feral animals, you know. Remember in college, my friends giving me a hard time because I was shaving wrong. I'm like, I thought this is how you did it. I learned it watching commercials on TV, you know, like the very basics of life you're not given, you know, you're not taught, you know, how to balance your checkbook. You're not taught how to cook, not taught how to shave. So there's so many different ways you can benefit foster kids. This happens to be my sweet spot because I'm a longtime bike guy. I know the bike industry. I know the bike people. I know the foster care system, and I can kind of talk to these foster kids on a level that hopefully they'll understand, and also give them some just basic, you know, mental rubrics that if they put into use and put into practice, they're going to be better off. So that's what I'm doing.
Is the kids that are coming and that are getting these bikes, is there a particular age that's a, you said sweet spot, I don't want to use it for that, but is there a certain age that's targeted at this, or is just any kid
any kid, and it's not like we check your foster care card. You know, if there's a kid in need that wants or needs a bike, we're gonna hook them up, you know. So even if you're not in the foster care system, if you want or need a bike, we're gonna try and take care of you. It would be great if we could get some basic information in advance, like how tall are you, how old are you? So like, you know, if you're 5 foot tall and you're 12 years old, I'm gonna expect you're growing, right? So I'm gonna try to figure that out accordingly. And then, you know, what's your planned use for the bike? So no, we'll take anything from BMX bikes to mountain bikes to old road bikes, cruisers, one of my neighbors gave me her auto bike, and like, I'll make it work. Somebody will want it. You remember those?
Oh yeah.
They had weights and the spokes that would shift based on centrifugal force, like anything you got.
How do the kids, if you or someone you know is like underprivileged and would be a candidate, how would they get that information over to you so they could be vetted for possibly getting a bike?
Yeah, so I'm working with the major organizations within the Bay Area who advocate and assist foster kids. But like I said, a lot of this background infrastructure that Mary was doing back in the day has died. So if you are a foster parent or you know a kid who needs a bike, just ping me. I'll do everything I can to help you, even if you're not in the system. You can email me at diablocolorados@gmail.com. Diablo like the mountain, Colorado like the state, S as in Sam at the end, diablocolorados@gmail.com. If people spam me, I'm just going to put you in my spam folder. You can hit me up on Instagram at diablocolorados. And if you know a kid that needs a bike, just ping me, let me know basic stats. I'll do everything I can to help so that we can plan accordingly. If you have an old bike, I don't really care what type it is, or what state of repair it's in, because even if I can't repair it, I could probably use some of the parts. Bring it to Pleasant Hill Police Department and say, hey, this is for the bike build. The bike build is September 23rd at 9 a.m. at Pleasant Hill City Park, which is on the corner of Gregory and Cleveland, across from City Hall, underneath the big oak tree, which if you know Pleasant Hill, you know the big oak tree.
Nice.
And that's where we're going to be. You're going to see a bunch of people. It's going to be a bike party. We're going to have, you know, a couple dozen bike mechanics. We're going to have a row of bikes. And I'm just doing everything I can to get the word out, because unfortunately the infrastructure behind this program has died the last couple of years and the need hasn't decreased. So,
yeah. Well, and if you're a mechanic that wants to help out, do you bring your toolbox with you, or are there sufficient tools there?
It's pretty much unsupported. I think the city is providing garbage cans.
Jeez, okay.
Like, I'm going to bring an umbrella and all the bike tools I can. And I'm emphasizing people, like, dude, these are cup and cone bearing hubs. These are wacky old bottom brackets, you know, loose ball headsets. So bring that 32 millimeter wrench in addition to all your metric, right? You don't know what we're going to end up with. And in the past, it has been like people yelling back and forth, like, who's got this? But it to me, it's a really fun environment. I enjoy
for sure
doing it. All the people that have joined in, it's just a really good experience all the way around. But yeah, it's unsupported. Bring your own tools. I'm going to bring a table, my work stand, all my tools in a tent, and some water. Hopefully somebody can bring some tunes. And it'll be a bike build party for a really good cause.
Yeah.
I've forgotten, you know, the location. I know the date. I've forgotten the location. Where can I find all this information? Where can we tell our listeners to go and look it up?
If you City of Pleasant Hill hasn't done a great job of conveying information specific to this event. They talk a lot about the Community Service Day. You Google Pleasant Hill Community Service Day, you'll find information about that. I have posted information on all the Bay Area Facebook groups. If you want to ping me direct, diablocolorados@gmail.com, you can. But to reiterate, this is at Pleasant Hill City Park, September 23rd at 9 a.m. Pleasant Hill City Park is on the corner of Gregory and Cleveland. I want to say it's 140 Gregory Lane, Pleasant Hill, California. And if you want to donate bikes, you can donate them prior to the 23rd by dropping them off at Pleasant Hill PD, which is at 330 Taylor Boulevard in Pleasant Hill, California, and just let them know it's for the bike build. If for some reason you can't get your bike there, ping me and I will do my best to go and pick it up. And we're going to have, you know, plenty of people helping in that regard as well. And if you want to make monetary donations, this is the first year we're doing that. But I mean, we're going to need tires and tubes and brake pads and cables and housing. Bicycle Trails Council of the East Bay has created a PayPal specific to this event. If you give me 1 second, I can pull that up. And that will be tax deductible. If we end up with any extra funds, I'm going to donate them to the foster care organizations like CASA, Braid Mission, what have you. So you can be assured it's going to help out foster kids one way or the other. Give me just a second and I'll have that email address for you.
You know,
Bicycle Trails Council has Bike Buildathon at btceb.org. Bike Buildathon, all one word, at btceb.org. And Mike, if you like, I can email you or send you all this information afterward.
Chuck, would you do that? Just send all that. So I'll put it on my personal Facebook page. Cycle Jerks has a personal Cycle Jerks has a Facebook page. We got Instagram. So I'd like to just make something up and use that to get the word out and tell our listeners to either come help or to donate their bikes, any bike parts.
Yep.
So yeah, Grady, an email would be fantastic.
I will.
All right. Well, Chuck, we should probably wrap it up here. We're heading up on 8:30. And we haven't even talked.
Tell me a little bit about the Facebook page though, too.
I was getting to that.
All right. Well, yeah, I thought you were cutting them off.
I know.
But I want to say one thing. It's not, God, I'm not going to solve world problems here, but you know, you said, Chuck, it's not just about the bike. It could be going fishing and all that, but you know, here's a perfect segue, right? They come pick up a bike. I mean, the world needs lots of bike mechanics, you know, somehow if we could just get them interested in, I mean, on some level, it saved you, right, Chuck? You know, going to work in a bike shop, and maybe that's a strong word.
But cycling saved my life. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, and so and the starting point for that is working on the bikes, right? So it just or one of the starting points. So it'd be awesome if these kids could come and see just the pure joy of riding, but also working on the bike.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be, you know, kind of an overt sort of obvious example, but like learning how to work on bikes, it's not rocket science, but it did create the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's a great way to put it. It's not rocket science, but it did create the airplane.
Yeah.
Or help.
So learning to be a bike mechanic is a great skill in and of itself. My buddy Judd went from being a bike mechanic to working in aerospace just because he was such a good mechanic. He got recruited. I did okay myself. Cycling bike people are in general just a really positive group of people to be around. They're healthy, intentionally healthy.
I'm laughing my ass off because a kid that was a mechanic in my bike shop, he started as a freshman. He struggled in school. He's a smart kid. He just struggled in school. It wasn't his gift. He struggled through high school. He struggled through college. He's now a mechanic for United Airlines.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's so many stories like that. Bicycle. But I think, Chuck, I think you really tapped into the biggest part of it is the overall community of cyclists, right? You have people that are intentionally healthy. Also, I think, you know, when you're explaining your story about having to make these decisions on firing some friends that weren't in your best interest, you know, when you're on your bike and it's just you and you're just pedaling, you know, it's you in your head. And you're able to spend a lot of time analyzing the things that are going on around you and in a way that people don't do on their own. We have too much stimulus. Even back then, as a young kid, you're being pulled in a lot of different directions. If you've got stress in your foster care situation, you're not being introspective and looking at your life and analyzing everything like you do when you're on your bike. It's something that's unique, I think, that all of us that are cyclists that spend hours a day, hours a week on the bike, we get this extra time that people don't take for themselves. And I think it really helps in many ways.
I do that a lot. I ride for a long time. Then I stop. I have a cigarette, you know, think some more.
No.
You mean insane.
Then an asthma attack. Yeah.
Then I ride some more.
Yeah, I grew up with asthma, and I don't have it today, thank goodness. But I would, that kept me away from drugs. You know, like all my buddies were into getting high, or there was some, one of my friends got into cigarettes, and it was just like, I couldn't be around it, you know? So I just had to push it away, because just for health reasons. So, you know, it helped me in a way, kind of stay away from all that. Cause it is very attractive to a lot of young kids, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I've been doing some bike advocacy as well lately with East Bay Regional Parks and stuff like that. And perception of mountain bikers, a lot of the older generation think that we're just like adrenaline junkies, but they forget that, you know, climbing is meditative. For me, yeah. There's nothing more meditative than climbing Mount Diablo in the fog when you can't see 20 feet ahead of you and all you experience is breathing and pedaling.
Yeah.
For an hour. There's nothing more meditative than that.
It's surreal.
You know, and then the experience, you know, riding in nature. I mean, you go out, you'll see peregrine falcons, red-tailed hawks, golden eagles, snakes, rattlesnakes. It's truly a nature experience as well. You learn the ecosystem. And then on the downhill, something that I kind of realized recently, the downhill for me isn't the adrenaline rush. It is the level of presence required to hit a hard downhill trail and not die. You're right in the zone. You're not worrying about the lady that chewed you out last week. You're trying not to die. For me, yeah. It's that level of presence that most people never experience. And there's so many different positive aspects to cycling that are kind of hard to describe, but every one of them is positive.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, listen, we didn't get to talk about Vintage DH Mountain bike group on Facebook, but yeah. I think what we did here today was really important. And, you know, I really appreciate you sharing your story with everybody. I know that it's, you know, hopefully it's going to touch a lot of people out there and motivate them to get involved in their community, look for opportunities to improve the life of these foster kids that are so challenged, you know, in so many ways. So
Chuck, you said you don't like it, but I think you should talk more about yourself. It's quite an inspiring story. No, I'm serious. It's an inspiring story. So I think more people could benefit from hearing it.
That's the only reason I'm doing it. I don't like talking about myself, but it's for the greater good.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get out of here, give us a quick rundown on the Vintage DH Mountain Bike group.
I don't know what it was several years ago. I saw a need for creating a forum for mountain bikers that are into vintage downhill bikes. And I started this thing on a whim, November 27th, 2017. And we're up to, I have two different groups. This is the Vintage Downhill Mountain Bike page, the Vintage Downhill Mountain Bike group. We're up to 40 something thousand people. Almost every country in the world. And it's really interesting. I see people from the Ukraine and Russia every day out riding their bikes and talking about bikes online with each other. And nobody cares. It's all just the love of bike. Yeah. I talk to people in Finland and Britain and New Zealand, like on a daily basis. And it's this community I've created. And one of the main things I try to encourage people is to help each other. We're all trying to build these crazy old downhill racing bikes and the parts that are impossible to find. And dude, you might find it in the Ukraine, and homeboy's going to help you get that, you know, Marzocchi super monster tea that you've been dreaming of since you were a kid. And it might just come from the Ukraine. And that's part of what we do. So I just did that because I saw a need and it absolutely just took off.
Yeah. Wow. 40,000 followers. That's incredible.
Incredible. Yeah.
From everyone.
Yeah. We should have you handle the Cycle Jerks podcast marketing.
I don't know what I did.
Because he's got so much time on his hands.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, listen, it's a good time to wrap it up. Chuck Davis, Chuck D, as I've known you all these years. It was really great having you on, man. And I think it's beautiful what you're doing, from foster kid getting a free bike to now running a program that's giving away bikes to foster kids.
From 0.3 GPA.
Yeah, maybe go back and thank those teachers.
I don't know. Not so sure about that one.
All right. Well,
thank you
again. Thanks for listening, everybody. And that's going to do it. We'll see you next week.
See you guys. Peace.
Bye.